From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the pressure is building on President Trump to make a decision on the DACA program.
We want to give people peace of mind. And so I've had plenty of conversations with the White House about this issue. And I think that's something that we in Congress are working on and need to deliver on.
Also today in our Week in Review, Houston in the aftermath of Harvey.
You know, to see our life literally float away, in a sense, and just being drowned. I got to swallow it and keep going.
Plus, as we head into the Labor Day weekend and the unofficial end of summer, let's step back into the office with Dwight Schrute.
Wow, these people here. There's too many people on this earth. We need a new plague.
A conversation with the man who brought Dwight to life, actor Rainn Wilson.
Wherever I went, people would be like, oh my God, look, it's Dwight.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Oh, hey, it's Dwight. I love you. Oh my God, you're so funny. Can I have my picture? You're amazing. Oh.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Almost 800,000 people in the U.S., 8,000 of them here in Massachusetts, are waiting on President Donald Trump to announce a decision that could change their lives. At the White House today, Trump said he would soon make a decision about the future of the DACA program, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
Sometime today or over the weekend, we'll have a decision. We love the dreamers. We love everybody. Thank you very much.
Well, DACA is the Obama-era federal program that allows undocumented young people who were brought to the country as children to remain in the United States while attending school without fear of deportation. Joining us now with more is WBUR's Edify reporter, Max Larkin. Hi there, Max.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, just remind us, what exactly does the DACA program do? What does and doesn't it provide to undocumented young people?
Well, compared to the big decisions that America has to make about its 11-plus million undocumented immigrants, DACA was really a very small step. It basically gave immigrants who came to the United States under the age of 16, a lot of them came very young, it gave them, put them at the bottom of the queue for immigration enforcement and gave them a way to legally work and learn in the United States. But it's important to note that it wasn't a path to citizenship. It wasn't even a long-term guarantee of safety. And even its defenders realized that because it's an executive order, it was subject to be turned over as soon as a new president arrived in the White House.
And DACA beneficiaries had to apply every 2 years. They also had to have no criminal record, be attending school. There is a long list that they have to check off.
Exactly. It was targeted at a particular portion of the population who are seen as being the most politically popular group of undocumented immigrants.
The dreamers, in other words.
Yes, that's right.
So what might happen to DACA beneficiaries, to these young people, if President Trump decides to end the program?
Well, of course, we're still waiting on the form that the policy change would take if he announces it in the next day or in the next few days. But it one way that you could conceivably do it is because it's a two-year renewal process, is you could just turn off the faucet of renewals, and then when people's DACA status lapses, they could find themselves no longer legally allowed to work or learn in the United States.
And then perhaps be subject to deportation.
Exactly,
as well.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the president himself has actually gone back and forth in his public remarks about the program. I mean, during the campaign, here's what he said about immigration and DACA. This is August of 2016.
We will immediately terminate President Obama's two illegal executive amnesties in which he defied federal law and the Constitution.
So a hard line there from then-candidate Trump. But in February, as president of the United States, he was asked about DACA at a press conference, and he said this.
We're going to show great heart. DACA is a very, very difficult subject for me, I will tell you. To me, it's one of the most difficult subjects I have because you have these incredible kids. You know, I love these kids. I love kids. I have kids and grandkids. And I find it very, very hard doing what the law says exactly to do. And, you know, the law is rough.
So, Max, what kind of pressure is on the president to reconcile these views?
Well, I think you can imagine it sort of as the devil on one shoulder or the angel, or two different voices. There are definitely people across the political sphere who imagine, who are making the case that DACA should remain, even surprising places. Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, for instance, opposes the policy, but he thinks that the solution to this problem comes through the legislature. Silicon Valley, many CEOs wrote a letter saying that the DACA recipients rescinding their status would cost the country trillions, $500 billion in productivity and billions more in taxes lost. So there's a bunch of people who want this program to remain as it is.
And disagreement within White House amongst members of Trump's own staff, I presume.
Yeah, as always, you hear conflicting reports that there are some aides who would like to see the policy stay and others who want it gone.
Well, and there's another kind of a deadline to this story set by the Attorney General of Texas. What's going on there?
Yeah, a lot of immigration advocates say Trump has fundamentally changed the face of enforcement of immigration in this country since he took over. But there are some people who think he's not being tough enough. And so there's a group of 10 attorneys general representing 10 different red states, and they are suing, saying that DACA represented executive overreach on behalf of the previous president, Barack Obama. But they will drop that suit if Trump unilaterally rescinds the program before September 5th, next Tuesday.
Now, of course, as we mentioned at the top of this conversation, Max, there are 8,000 young people in Massachusetts who could be affected by the president's decision as and when it comes. And, you know, again, the program was designed to allow these young people to go to school without fear of deportation. How are colleges and universities in the area reacting to what might happen?
Yeah, there's definitely a broad pushback to this. Boston Public Schools Superintendent Tommy Chang said that we really don't want to go back. Harvard President Drew Faust said she effectively pled with the White House to keep the policy in place. Harvard has a number of DACA students of its own. One of the things that I think is interesting is how much emotional support these people want to give to students who are undocumented. There was enormous peace of mind that DACA students describe feeling while this policy was in place. And they're worried that rescinding the policy will send those students back to a painful uncertainty, as well as imperiling their status here in the country.
Well, that's Max Larkin, reporter for WBUR's Edify. Max, thank you so much.
Thanks, Meghna.
Well, let's speak to one of those young people who may be in a dangerous kind of limbo here when the president makes his decision. Paola is joining us in the studio, and she's asked her to refer to her as Paola for obvious reasons, out of concern for her status. But she is just about to start her freshman year of college at UMass Boston, and she's with us now. Paola, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, I mean, how are you feeling today, knowing that the president might make some kind of decision about the DACA program any day now?
So it makes me nervous because it just puts my future on the line, because it all depends. If it stays, then I'm going to be able to finish my career at UMass Boston. If it goes, then I might not be able to continue at UMass Boston.
I mean, if it goes, do you know what you're going to do, what you could do? I mean, is that something you've been thinking about?
So my first semester of college, thanks to scholarships, has been covered. But going forward, if the DACA is taken away, then I would have to probably step out of UMass Boston, since the price is very high, because I would be considered an out-of-state student. And then I would have to probably, my best option would be to get my associates at a community college.
Mm. Now, you were brought to the United States from El Salvador, is that
correct? Correct.
How old were you?
I was 9 years old.
What do you remember about that time?
I don't remember much. I remember my family that's over there, but if you ask me about El Salvador, I couldn't really tell you much about it.
Hmm. I mean, so do you consider the United States your country, your home?
I would consider the United States my home. This is where most of my family is. Even though I still have family in El Salvador, my life was built here. I was technically raised here.
Yeah. And so, you know, Max was saying earlier that when the DACA program was first instituted, it gave a lot of young people peace of mind. At least for every 2 years, there would be some stability. How much has that peace of mind meant to you?
It has meant a lot, because even having my status during my senior year of high school, it was very difficult to choose a college that I could go to. And I was able to find a way to pay for it. So that gave me peace of mind, because the reason I'm here is to build my career, to be somebody, and to have better opportunities that I would have back in my country. So it has, I know I can work. I know I have opportunities to help my family out. And that's why it gave me peace of mind.
Hmm. Has there ever been an opportunity for you, or have you ever seen a potential path to citizenship, if that's what you want?
As of now, I've asked, I've been to multiple lawyers, but as of now, there's no path to citizenship. But I think that just having DACA just makes me very calm and gives me, like you said, peace of mind.
Yeah. So what is it that you want for your future? What do you want to do?
So I'm going to UMass Boston to study international relations. And with that, I want to be an advocate for immigrant youth. I know I've had multiple opportunities, and that's why I'm able to go to college. But there's a lot of even DACA recipients that don't find the opportunities they need to continue their education, so they become discouraged. So I want to study some sort of politics and be an advocate, whether through a nonprofit or even if I get the chance to citizenship, to be able to work in the government and advocate for immigrant youth.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder, what would you say to people who say, you know what, we understand that you were brought here as a child. You didn't necessarily have a choice. You were 9 years old. But nevertheless, they still look upon your undocumented status as, as illegal in their eyes. And that just by virtue of that, that you shouldn't be here. I mean, what's your response to folks who think that way?
I think that I have... maybe not necessarily the right, but I have the choice of being here. I think, as I've said before, that a paper does not make me any more or any less than any other youth in this country. I'm pursuing an education. I'm working on every chance that I get. I'm making something for myself, and I don't think I'm taking anything away from anybody.
Well, that's Paola. She's going to be a freshman at UMass Boston this fall. She is here currently under the DACA program, but is one of the 8,000 young people in Massachusetts who could face a high degree of instability and uncertainty if President Trump rescinds the DACA program. He's going to make an announcement about that either today or sometime this weekend. Paola, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and yes, it is Friday, so let's take a look at the week that was. And our fine panelists for our week in review today, Dante Ramos. He is an op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe and editor of the Globe's Sunday Ideas section. Dante, it's good to see you again.
Great to be here.
Also with us, John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and senior analyst for WBUR and the scribe of multiple very fine blogs, which you should read. John, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well.
I see the checks are clearing.
Exactly. I can go buy myself a cup of coffee now.
Excellent.
All right. Well, gentlemen, first of all, since DACA is in the news, and we just had a conversation before the break about it. I was wondering if I could get your quick takes. I mean, Dante, what do you make of the fact that the president may rescind this program that could have an impact on 8,000 young people here in Massachusetts?
I think his stance on this is something that is very important to the people who he thinks elected him. It's unfortunate that things have reached this point because, as we just heard, this is the result of Congress not over the course of a decade or more,
right,
not doing anything to deal with a sort of anomalous situation, which is having a large number of unauthorized immigrants in the country. And while all of that deliberation has gone on and nothing has come out of it, you have a student who was brought here at age 9 from another country and has lived the last decade under a cloud of uncertainty. And I think it's unfortunate that the human toll of that isn't first on the minds of all of the people making this decision.
John?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one more example of Donald Trump as America's first Cubist president. I mean, he's on every side of every issue. And, you know, he can agonize all he wants and play Hamlet all he wants about this. But, you know, he should really be out lobbying Congress to pass legislation.
Yeah.
That would be the solution.
I wonder if that's what's going on here, right? He's going to satisfy his base by rescinding the program, but he's kind of signaling under the table, Congress, you can at least get this done, if not comprehensive immigration reform, no, but this one thing, and maybe he'd sign that legislation.
It's possible. I mean, you also look, there's the human cost that Dante you know, mentions, no question, but there's also a financial cost. I mean, this will cost a lot of money to the U.S. economy. The one estimate is $433 billion lost over 10 years if the DACA dreamers are sent out of the country. So, I mean, there are real financial implications as well as human implications in this, and I'm not sure that people have really paid much attention to those either.
I'd throw in the moral implications as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll see what the president decides to do as and when he announces his decision on DACA. Let's move on to the biggest story by far of the week, and that is Hurricane Harvey, then Tropical Storm Harvey, now just Harvey, but it's the catastrophe it has wrought in Texas. We have some tape here of Texans. This is Lily Galindo. She's from Dickinson, Texas, about 40 minutes outside of Houston. She told the Associated Press about the damage done to her house.
I'm honestly at a loss for words. I just know I have work to do, and I'm a single mom with three girls. So, you know, to see our life literally float away, in a sense, and just being drowned, I got to swallow it and keep going.
Yeah, and here's Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He spoke this morning on ABC.
This is going to be a massive, massive cleanup process. It's going to be far larger in scope than Katrina was because the geographic area covered was far larger. This is not going to be a short-term project. This is going to be a multi-year project for Texas to be able to dig out of this catastrophe.
Dante, let's start with you. You were in New Orleans, living and working there during Katrina, so you have firsthand experience about the devastation these kind of storms can bring. I mean, what are your thoughts when you see what's happening in Houston?
I think what the governor of Texas just said is exactly right. If you're watching these things from a distance on television, it's a news story. You see 1 week, 2 weeks of coverage, and then the next thing happens, and you know, the attention of the world moves on once the acute crisis is over. And the thing to understand about having 4 feet of water in houses or larger amounts of water in houses is that's a lot of drywall to be taken out. That's a lot of supplies of things that people would normally consume, food, clothing, just stuff that gets hauled out on the curb. It's an extraordinarily difficult process. And the sheer number of homes, it's staggering. You know, I don't think that the TV camera is quite, you'll see an individual house, but when you see block after block after block, or square mile in this case, after square mile of inundation, it's hard to really express that through a television camera.
You know, so Houston is America's, what, fourth largest city, something like that? So massive in scope and scale. But if there's, maybe it's too early to say, you know, is there good news here? But I want to find a little bit of optimism here, John, because I think unlike with Katrina, where we saw immediate failures of response and government in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, we haven't seen that in Houston, which is a little ray of sunshine here.
It certainly is. And there's a couple of areas where Houston is very different from Katrina. One of them, it's much bigger, and it has an economy that is actually reasonably solid and reasonably robust. So that's going to be a little bit easier to come back on from than Katrina. New Orleans has an economy that's based on tourism. So almost by definition, a lot of the economic rebound was denied to them because it just wasn't going to happen. You know, I think the other thing is we have seen a lot of people come together here as opposed to Katrina. And one thing that seemed to happen in Katrina, and Dante maybe can speak to this more fully, is there was a racial component to the reaction to Katrina that we don't see here. And I think that that's encouraging as well. The last thing I'll say is anybody who says this is going to be a short-term turnaround and recovery is the president of the United States, because that's what he went down and told them. And I think that's a real disservice to people. I think the governor and the mayor of Houston are both telling the truth and giving them realistic views.
Well, we have a little bit of tape here from the president. This is him from Wednesday. After he was in Texas, he went to Missouri, and here's what he said.
To the people of Houston and across Texas and Louisiana, we are here with you today. We are with you tomorrow, and we will be with you every single day after to restore, recover, and rebuild.
I mean, Dante, you have written about this, right? I mean, you wrote this week that there will be second-guessing armchair experts, criticizing the response to this disaster. But this could have happened anywhere to anyone. And your point is that maybe we shouldn't be so critical.
Well, I think that a lot of different areas have risk factors. Obviously, if you're on the Gulf Coast, you're located on warm water, you're likely to get more intense hurricanes. On the other hand, I'm not sure until about 5 years ago, many of us would have thought that the second most expensive hurricane in the United States would have been in New York and New Jersey.
Right.
That was a storm surge of event rather than a rain event. It's also, by the way, the type of event that Boston would be more susceptible to. So, there are risk scenarios that the federal government has that San Francisco, a big earthquake on the West Coast, hurricanes on the Gulf Coast, terrorist attacks on the East Coast. But as Hurricane Sandy showed us, there's also the possibility of a very destructive hurricane in a northerly area. So, I think people should count their blessings and reserve a measure of judgment.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Sandy because, as much as I wanted to keep politics out of this, it's impossible, right? Because one of the sub stories that emerged over the week was that, most of the Republican members of the Texas congressional delegation voted against the Sandy recovery bill. And of course, now we hope that nobody votes against a recovery bill for Texas. So, I mean, it's like, you need the federal government when the disaster's in your own backyard.
Right. And I think Representative Peter King from New York said it the best. He said, just because you guys didn't vote to send help to us, that doesn't mean we're not going to vote to send help to you. And I think he looked directly at the Texas delegation. Actually, the Louisiana delegation was far more generous when Superstorm Sandy hit in terms of voting for disaster relief. So I think that this is going to happen. I mean, there's a lot of hypocrisy on the Republican side in that back then. Then they wanted all that money offset by cuts. Now they don't want all that money offset by cuts. So I think that, because it's in their backyard, they have a different set of principles now. But I don't think that it's going to get in the way. I don't think there's going to be a revenge factor in Congress that's going to get in the way of relief for Houston.
Dante, your thoughts on that?
I agree completely. I think one thing that the generosity of the Louisiana delegation around Sandy shows is that once this kind of thing has happened to you, you see it through a somewhat different lens. And it was awfully easy for more ideologically minded members of the Republican congressional delegation to say, no, we're going to deny New York and New Jersey money. But it's hard to do that when that's your own constituents. And as a matter of human decency, you shouldn't deny them.
Yeah.
Can I just add one quick thing? This calls for some kind of reform of flood insurance, because the vast majority of people, and there are 400,000 homes that were significantly damaged, that's by one estimate, the vast majority of them have no flood insurance at all. And I think that the system has to be looked at, because private insurance companies don't offer it. The federal government offers limited, and there's a move afoot in Congress to make it even more expensive.
Right.
So all the people, anybody who can afford it now, maybe they can't afford it down the road. So I think that this is really a call for someone to look at this system and try to reform it in some way.
And we can only expect that this is going to happen, perhaps not a 60-inch rain event, but, major storms and hurricanes, like you were saying earlier, Dante, in multiple places in the United States with climate change, with coastal communities growing the way they have.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with John's point, too, about flood insurance. It's a really complicated problem, but that said, there are a lot of people along the coast who do not now have flood insurance who probably should have flood insurance. A lot of the places that were inundated in Houston were outside of any recognized floodplain.
Right.
And I think that maybe one way to bring more money into the system is to have more people realize, hey, that maybe this is something we need.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to a little bit of more tape here of Voices from Houston. This is Robert Picard. He is from the Massachusetts chapter of the American Red Cross. He is helping out in Houston. He spoke with us yesterday.
In the first few weeks or month of disaster, the public is very generous. And then after a while, they stop. They forget, or something else supplants it in the news, because another disaster comes along, even if it's not at the same scale. And this is going to be months for basic recovery. And for the city to recover its full economic base will be years.
So he's taking the very long view there based on what he's seeing in Houston. But I want to bring it back here to the United States, to Boston, just for we are the hub, I guess, for a moment here, because Mayor Marty Walsh, he was on Boston Herald Radio on Wednesday. He was asked about, what would happen if a storm like Harvey hit home here.
If Harvey hit Boston Harbor, we're wiped out as a city. I mean, there's not much. We can't prevent it today. Right. What we can do is evacuate, make sure that people get out of their homes, make sure that we have contingency plans for people that get out of their homes. Make sure that we have plans for rebuilding. Make sure that we don't have looting that's going on in Houston right now, and make sure that we clamp down on public safety in the community. That's all we could do right now.
John, let me turn to you on this, because this is a tough one for Boston. Because on the one hand, again, a 60-inch rain event, hopefully we won't see that in 500 years. But they did just have one in Houston. On the other hand, the city's getting built up at record pace. We got to have some sort of comprehensive, and we do, but is it enough, a comprehensive plan to be resilient in the face of these kind of events?
No, I don't think it's enough. I think it's really unlikely that a Harvey-like event would happen in Boston. For it to linger for 5 days, that's just not how the weather works here, really. Usually, it comes through with a bang, and then it's gone. No city could handle 50 inches of rain over 5 days. But I think that there are things that Boston should be looking to do, and the big challenge is not to figure out what to do. It's to figure out how to convince people to pay for it, because that's one of the problems down in Houston. I mean, they've had three major floods over the past 3 years, and each one of them has initially said or indicated that, we should be doing something about this, but the will's not there, the money's not there. And I think that's the biggest issue of all. You could go to Amsterdam and look at what they're doing, and they spend a lot of money there. We could spend a lot of money here, but for people to actually accept the fact that that's what's needed, not talk, not evacuation plans, but actually money spent, that's a really hard thing to do.
Dante?
I concur absolutely. The 50-inch rainstorm is not the kind of – is probably very unlikely here, but storm surge, the wall of water pushed into the harbor, and harbors tend to narrow, so it's a triangular area. It gets higher the farther into the harbor you get. That's the kind of thing that we should worry about. Houston is actually on relatively high ground, by the way, relative to some place like Galveston or New Orleans. But if you stepped back, you could say that, in Boston, in the Back Bay, it's called the Back Bay, there are $800,000 basement apartments built on former title flats. And you could step back if you were an uncharitable member of the Texas congressional delegation circa 2040 and say, oh, my God, why did they spend so much money on basement apartments? That's ridiculous. But we need to be thinking about grander solutions to these issues. There have been discussions about some kind of larger hurricane barrier across the harbor. The environmental issues are complicated. The cost is enormous, but it's something that needs to be discussed.
This is one of those fundamental challenges in terms of like our human and community capacity to think about the value that we get out of spending money now to be protected versus the potential costs in the future of not doing so. It's a tough sell, especially when the dollar figures are as high as they are. All right. So before we wrap up for today, there is another story that I wanted to just touch on really quickly. And that's the fact that Governor Charlie Baker has proposed new legislation. And it's interesting because this would target drug dealers and it would create a new manslaughter charge for drug dealers where the drug sale leads to a user's death. And it would also create a mandatory minimum sentence for 5 years for anyone caught selling any drugs, not just opiates. And these are drugs that would lead to someone's death. The governor spoke about the proposal on Wednesday.
What I want is a statute that will basically say that if you knowingly sell somebody carfentanil, fentanyl, a mix of those two with something else, a certain kind of dose of heroin, whatever it happens to be, if they die, that we can charge you with manslaughter.
That's a really interesting proposal here. Dante, what's your thought on that?
Mandatory minimums sentences are something that was a crime-fighting tool of the 90s and in most ways are being rolled back because states and the federal government to some degree have found that they're inflexible. I would suspect that this law in practice would have a similar effect. I understand from a moral perspective wanting someone who knowingly, as the governor put it, put carfentanil or fentanyl in, sold that to someone, that the seller would be punished. I think these things in practice tend not to be that neatly. And did the dealer who's selling to feed a habit, did that person know that what exactly they were selling?
Yeah.
The history of drug prosecutions has been that they tend to trying to pick up people who are fairly low in the food chain, and where the carfentanil enters the supply of opiates that are being sold to people on the street, I have no idea. But it, you worry about not getting the people who are truly responsible.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, Governor Baker has talked about walking up the ladder and going after the big dealers as well as the small dealers. But I think Dante's right. In practice, it doesn't happen all that much. Another issue that some people have brought up is essentially discouraging people from calling 911 because you think you may be subject to this law if there's an overdose occurring, and so you don't basically want to get involved in that, and that could lead to more opioid deaths. I mean, they're 900 and something already this year, opioid deaths in Massachusetts. There were 2,000 last year. So I think that anything that discourages people from addressing the problem and from acting when someone is in danger of overdosing is problematic. I think in theory this is probably a good idea. I think in practice that's where it's going to be problematic because I think that it's in a way criminalizing opioid addiction to some degree.
Yeah, but I can imagine on the other hand many people look at the governor's proposal and say it's exactly the right thing to do because what it's discouraging is people selling some of these drugs that could lead to these overdoses. But we'll talk about it more next week as we get a better sense of as to what the proposal is. Okay, can we do a lightning round here with our hubbubs because we got 60 seconds to get them all in there. So Dante, your hubbub.
Okay, well, it's the most wonderful time of the year for people who like free furniture and also like moving. It's Alston Christmas. Data science now allows you to see a heat map of where the moving van permits have been issued. Unfortunately, data science has not solved the worst design glitch in Boston, which is that you can get onto Storrow Drive in a truck that is taller than you can drive along Storrow Drive because of the overpasses.
Alston Christmas, everybody.
Structural problems, right?
All right, John, you got 20 seconds.
Very quickly, out at the Berkshire Museum, there's a big rumpus over selling off 40 artworks, two of them paintings by Norman Rockwell. A group came along this week and offered $1 million to the museum to just put the sale on hold. They won't. Everything goes on sale at Sotheby's this fall.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. Well, mine had to do with Samsung. I'm going to hold it until next week. Just say when Samsung's phones don't blow up in your face, their advertising campaigns might do just that. John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University, and Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist for The Globe. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this quick little news note, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, says that the President Trump, is going to have an announcement on the DACA program on Tuesday. So that little news note. Now, since it is Friday, can we just step away from the news for a moment for this last part of the show? Because I'd like us all to take a breather as we head into the Labor Day weekend, because it also happens to be the unofficial end of summer, meaning for most of us soon it'll be back to the office. So we thought it'd be fun to listen back to one of our favorite conversations with one of the actors from the beloved NBC series The Office. It's Rainn Wilson. He played the deliciously weird and wicked office bully Dwight Schrute.
People say, oh, it's dangerous to keep weapons in the home or the workplace. Well, I say, it's better to be hurt by someone you know accidentally than by a stranger on purpose.
That's the Dwight we all know and love. And yet, BJ Novak describes actor Rainn Wilson as, quote, more grounded, warm, thoughtful, articulate than you'd ever imagine. The reason why is made evident in Wilson's memoir. It's called The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy. It's a fascinating read. I mean, Hollywood is the high temple for modern-day celebrity worship, so it surprised me to discover that Wilson is a deeply committed member of the Baha'i faith. He's also strongly connected to his parents, despite, as he writes, their bizarre failures and absences in his life. Which is why, when we talked with Rainn Wilson back in November of 2015, I began by telling him that his memoir felt like an ode to love.
Wow, an ode to love, like Proust, kind of?
Look, you're a man who quotes Rilke in the first chapter.
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of pretentious quotes in there. That's really interesting. I'm going to think about that, an ode to love. Yeah, there's a lot of exploration in this. You know, when I pitched the book, I said, listen, there's going to be some stuff that's going to be spiritual in here, and I'm going to strive for some profundity, and I've got to share some deep, dark truths about my life and, you know, and a lot of, you know, warts and all kind of stuff, and make myself really vulnerable, and there's going to be some big ideas in it, and the publishers weren't scared. So, you know, I don't know that I succeeded, but I swung for the fences on this one because I wanted it to be really funny, but I also wanted it to be as profound as I could make it.
Okay, well, I'd love to sort of share in detail with listeners the sense of that profundity, because I'm sure they're probably sitting here, those people who don't know your story are sitting here thinking, wait, this guy plays Dwight on The Office, and we're talking about profound spirituality, but it's true. So can you read a little section of your book? Because
sure.
I would love to hear you tell this story. And it has to do when you went to Tufts.
Yep.
And this was a moment of divine inspiration that you had, because you weren't quite sure what you wanted to do with your life. But you say that you had a mystical experience when you went to go watch A Chorus Line at a government center multiplex. So can you tell us a little bit of that story and then read to us the moment of divine inspiration?
Yeah, I was trying to decide whether to become an actor or not. And really, like, because I knew, because my dad was a failed artist and he'd wanted to paint and he wanted to write and never worked out for him. I knew that if you wanted to be a professional artist, I didn't know any professional artists, but I imagined that you would have to devote 10, 15, 20 years to it, that you have to dive in completely. And that was a very scary thing for me at 19 years old. And I was trying to decide whether to go to India with my friend who was going to go travel for a year, or to go to acting school, maybe go to New York and really like dive into the whole acting thing. I didn't know what to do. And my decision was kind of made for me seeing this matinee of A Chorus Line right here in Boston.
Okay, so read to us what happened.
All right. Sitting by myself in the dark of a near empty matinee in a theater near Government Center, Boston, I started to ugly cry. This is while watching the film. Full-on, grotesque, racking sobs during What I Did for Love, the kind where you're sort of gulping for air. As all these actors and singers and dancers were longing and yearning to act and sing and dance, I felt a kinship in my heart which lunged towards the screen as if it would burst. I stepped out of the theater, tears drying on my cheeks, into one of the most beautiful sunsets I'd ever seen. Red and orange light was streaming through snowflakes that had begun to quietly fall from the Boston sky. The ground, the multiplex, the high-spired churches and offices of that great city were being dusted with white, and time, once again, seemed to slow down and stop like a train pulling into a station. I gazed up into the sky and took several deep breaths, noticing that a deeply calm, passionate decision seemed to be dropping down into my body. I decided to go for it. I knew I had to become an actor. There was no turning back. It was my calling, my vocation. The entire course of my life changed outside of a multiplex during Christmas of 1985 after viewing one of the worst movies of the 1980s, True Story.
That's actor Rainn Wilson reading from his memoir, The Bassoon King. When I got to that page, I just thought, we have to have him read this because this is one of the moments that you talk about in the book of letting yourself accept some kind of divine inspiration. Mm-hmm. Did it feel divine at the time?
You know, there's several of these moments. It's an interesting exercise to write one's memoir. I firmly believe everyone should do it because it gives you an incredibly valuable perspective. And you look back on my 49 years and I see these waypoints, these little special little hinge moments that without which I wouldn't have the life that I have. It all adds up to something, but there are these turning points. Did they feel divine at the time? I don't know. Sometimes they certainly didn't seem as profound as looking back on them, I realize they were.
Well, so I keep mentioning divinity, but we should explain that you're a member of the Baha'i faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have been since you were born, right?
Yeah, my
parents. But you've come in and out of it, though.
Exactly. My parents were Baha'is. I grew up Baha'i, was raised Baha'i, and was very into it as a kid and as a teen. And it was great because I learned all these wonderful teachings of the Baha'i faith, the equality of men and women and the unity of the races of humanity, the essential harmony of the world's religions, the harmony of science and religion, these great teachings. But when I moved to New York City to become an actor, like right after what I just read there, I rejected it all. And I didn't want anything to do with faith, religion, God, morality. And it was about 12 years I was really outside of the Baha'i faith or any faith. And so a big through line in the book is my spiritual journey and finding my way back to the Baha'i faith.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the portion where you, when you rejected it all, I mean, that part actually kind of reads like a classic Hollywood fall from grace almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, cocaine played a role.
Yeah. It's like any VH1 Behind the Music, when the band falls apart after their initial success.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't even had any success and I fell apart. Yeah. I went off the rails in a lot of different ways back then. Yeah. And it wasn't like hardcore. It's not like, oh, I was this heroin addict. And it's not that story. It's not that kind of total addiction story. But it was, I got lost in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, let's go back even further, if we could, to when you grew up, when you were really, really young, growing up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that part spoke to me, too, because I grew up in Oregon. I'm a native Northwesterner.
Nice.
As well. Although I've been living here in Boston for a while, so I don't know what that makes me. But your parents weren't exactly down the middle, conventional 1960s, 70s parents, were they?
No, they weren't. My mom wanted to name me Thucydides after the Greek historian. My dad wanted to name me Rainer after Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet. And they lived on a houseboat in Seattle, very bohemian kind of lifestyle, painting murals. And my mom was actually an actress in experimental theater in Seattle in the late 60s and I think did a play where she kind of infamously ran around painted blue and topless and naked, which really wasn't done much in those days. It was a very odd upbringing. After she left, my parents got a divorce and I ended up living in Nicaragua for several mm-hmm. years on the Caribbean coast and had a lot of crazy misadventures there. So, the long story short of it, looking back on it, is I'm a kind of an odd dude, but I really have played all these outsider characters that are alienated, kind of misfits. And because I relate to that so much. I really was an alienated misfit in so many different ways growing up.
Right. So, I mean, there's and it's your parents' sort of approach to the world didn't come out of anywhere, didn't come out of nowhere either. I mean, because you write how your mother's mother died.
Yeah.
and her father was a farmer, and so she spent a lot of time growing up with chickens and pigs, like,
yeah,
while her dad was off working on the farm. And
yeah,
then your father's mother died because she was in a sanatorium and she was going to visit her kids, but
it's the most tragic story I've ever heard in my
hit
life.
Her head
she
had, and just died.
She had tuberculosis. She got better from tuberculosis. She had been in a sanatorium for years And my dad was like 9 years old, and they went to go pick her up to take her home. And she ran over to see them out the window in the courtyard. And then she ran to go get her coat and leave and fell down and hit her head on a radiator and died just like that.
And your dad was what, eight?
I think he was 8 or 9 years old.
And you're right that he sort of sits at the table afterwards and asks his father, who's going to take care of me now?
Yeah, who's going to take care of me now?
And that's what it all comes down to.
That's the line, isn't it?
So I'm asking you about all of this. We're doing this like therapy session here because...
I know, this is very deep. I love it.
Well,
this is good.
You're the one who gave me the material
all right.
in the book. But
fair enough.
Because, you know, I keep having to remind myself as I was reading this, this is the guy who is a world-famous actor who plays a character or played a character on TV for a couple hundred episodes that's like the opposite of all of this. You know,
but I can be a big fat jerk face too. Just watch. Just wait. Ask my wife.
We have 6.5 more minutes for you to prove that here.
Okay.
Not that I'm challenging you to do that. But were there parts of this sort of unorthodox upbringing that did make its way into Dwight, the character?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the reminiscences that I have, I don't even think I talked about it in the book so much, is I have this realization that because things were so odd in my family, with my stepmom who kind of raised me and my dad and my birth mother, that I didn't know how normal people acted. So I spent a lot of time in my childhood and in my teens trying to figure out how normal people related to one another. It was this kind of very kind of oddly detached, almost like how an android would kind of be watching human beings, or an alien posing as a human being, like, oh, these people are friends and they're happy. Oh, and look, and they hug in a carefree, jovial way. And they embrace and they laugh. And
does not compute.
Yeah. No, I would take notes and be like, oh, that's what I should do. Next time I would see someone I like, I would try and laugh jovially and embrace in a similar way that I saw other people do it. Because my family was so odd that so it does relate to Dwight. I mean, because Dwight kind of does that too. He doesn't obey the rule. There's the Schrute rules of human interaction are very, very different than the normal cultural rules of human interaction.
Hmm. But on the other hand, you did write in the book that it was really interesting for you that you go from, I mean, you write about how in your teen years you are like a classic nerd, right? The bassoon playing the chess club.
Mm-hmm. Chess team, baby.
Chess
we competed.
Playing the bassoon because your teacher told you it would be better than playing the saxophone. All these things that make you a card-carrying nerd.
Yep, Dungeons and Dragons, sure.
Of course, we had to get the role-playing in there. But you write that you go from being that to a couple decades later being this like hero, this nerd hero. And in the book you say it's an exhilarating, that realization was exhilarating and incredibly challenging at the same time.
Yeah.
So the challenging part.
Yeah. So for someone who always considered themselves an outsider and kind of a weirdo, and I was just trying to make it as a character actor, and all of a sudden to just like wherever I went, people would be like, oh, my God, look, it's Dwight. Oh, hey, it's Dwight. I love you. Oh, my God, you're so funny. Can I have my picture? You're amazing. Oh, you know, to get that like wherever I go, right? Not wherever, but a lot of places where I go. Especially back when the show was on the air, is pretty weird. It's a very strange, and it's like it's exciting. You know, I'd worked for 14 years as a professional actor before I did The Office. Hardly ever got recognized ever, and then to kind of be put on this weird pedestal was pretty astonishing. And it's challenging. Why? Because, man, it's so easy to get entitled. It's so easy. The human ego is a very insidious creature inside of us that wants attention and accolade and status. And there's a constant wrestling with ourselves we have to do. And when everyone is just giving you everything, just like, here's free stuff. Or here, do you want a free trip? And we love you wherever you go. Like, you start to believe the hype. And it's not like I was like this raging jerk face. But, well, sometimes I was. But it shifts your perspective in these insidious ways.
Right.
fame and entitlement.
And celebrity, yeah. And that, I mean, Hollywood, yeah. You write, you use the word, you have the phrase spiritually questionable, right? I mean.
Yeah. And so it's been a struggle, you know, that's been a battle. And think about, you know, the Justin Biebers of the world or the people that are just, that get instantly famous and they're like 16 and the entire world is giving them on a platter.
Yeah.
You know, I have to constantly remind myself, like, look, I'm just this dorky Dungeons and Dragons playing actor from Seattle, and I happened to get lucky and get on this one TV show that got hot for a while.
Well, it was more than luck, because obviously your skill as an actor helped a great deal. But we've got like 30 seconds left, and I know it goes by fast, but I do want to just read a little bit from the last chapter of your book, because your spirituality and your faith play such a huge role here. The last chapter is 10 Things I Know for Sure. And it starts with number one, the deepest happiness comes from service to others, to number 10, which is, I still don't know anything.
True.
After all that time, still don't know anything.
Yeah, I'm gonna start over. I'm gonna write my next memoir for the next 50 years. Maybe I'll learn something.
Well, we'll have you back hopefully before 50 years go by.
Okay. That's bassoon playing in the background.
Yes, it is.
Oh, you did that for me.
We think about it all, actually. That's the delightful Rainn Wilson. He spoke with us back in November 2015 when his memoir, The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy first came out. That's it for today and this week. Have a marvelous weekend. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.